from.
Solartopia, Solartopia, don't you know we're gonna have a Solartopia.
What is your Skype address?
Now we're fighting wars over oil and gas. No matter who wins, it will not last. The earth is scarred, the planet is warming. Don't you think that all of it's a great big warning?
Don't you know we're gonna have a Solartopia, Solartopia, Solartopia. Don't you know we're gonna have a Solartopia all over the
This is Harvey Wasserman here for the Solartopia Green Power and Wellness Show. I hope everything is good. We've got a phone problem at the studio. And so we are reverting to Skype, with which I've had mixed luck. And we are going to have our guest, Peter Matthews, a really great guest, try and Skype in on his own. So we are going to get our bearings here, and we're going to move ahead. This is the Solartopia Green Power and Wellness Show back again for another hour, and I am going to talk to you a while until we get Peter Matthews. He's got a lot to talk about, and we'll have a good time with it. So I just came back yesterday. We want to talk about a little bit. Well, first of all, I want to talk about my governor, John Kasich, here. I just got a note, read it on the internet, that John Kasich, the governor of Ohio, has announced that if he's elected president, God forbid, if he's elected president, he's going to rename Mount McKinley in Alaska. This is the level that these idiots are on. I have met John Kasich a couple times when he came into the governorship of Ohio, courtesy of $1 million, a last minute funding from Rupert Murdoch. First thing he did was he killed a $400 million grant from the federal government to restore train service between Columbus and Cleveland, and then Cincinnati as well. And he did this with no consultation. He just came in and like a dictator, and said that, you know, you people are idiots. You worked for 10 years to get this money. We don't need trains. I don't have to ride a train. I ride around in a limousine. And he just killed the program. Hundreds and hundreds of jobs, $400 million investment, towns all up and down the highway there, the railway that would have been good for riding.
Was there an Adam? Was there an Eve? Or did we evolve from what we conceived? Either way, we are.
And so let's see if we're doing this. Okay, and so now you know they're all fighting for media attention. All these Republicans. Democrats are too, but at any rate, Kasich, being an Ohio guy, comes out, and as you know, I'm sure Barack Obama has changed the name of Mount Denali in Alaska back to Mount Denali. It was named for William McKinley, for a number of reasons, which are not entirely agreed upon. But one seems to be that some gold miner was up in Alaska, and McKinley, being a big fan of the gold standard, made gold more valuable. And so this gold miner said he wanted to call Mount Denali, which is the Indian name, which had been the name of this mountain for centuries, thousands of years, changed it off the top to honor Mount McKinley, who he never met. And William McKinley was a mediocre politician at best. I mean, you know, he was shot in 1901, giving way to Theodore Roosevelt. But William McKinley was has absolutely nothing really to recommend him, except that McKinley won the election of 1896 by stealing it, or having it stolen by his campaign manager, Mark Hanna, and then got shot in 1901, gave way to Teddy Roosevelt. But in the meantime, he annexed Hawaii and waged the Spanish-American War, which was based on a lie. For those of you who are interested, I'll tell you that in a minute. So Obama goes up there to Hawaii, and at the request of the native peoples of Hawaii, has changed the name back to its original name, Mount Denali. So in comes John Kasich, our what am I going to call him? I'll just call him our governor. And he's screaming and yelling now that Obama had no right to rename Mount McKinley back to its original name, Mount Denali, the Native American name, and that when he's president, God forbid, the first thing he's going to do is change Mount Denali back to Mount McKinley. This is what takes up the brain space of our esteemed politicians. And, of course, Kasich probably knows very little about William McKinley and nothing about the Native Americans who did the original naming of this mountain. Now, I want to mention to you that the Spanish-American War that McKinley presided over, and which was used by the United States to annex Cuba for a while, and then and Puerto Rico, which we still have, and the Philippines for a while, and Guam, which we still have, that was based on a lie. William McKinley, at the behest of the Hearst Yellow Journalism Empire, sent the battleship Maine to Havana Harbor to sort of throw our weight around against the Spaniards. The Spaniards were being fought by the Cuban people in the rebellion to get them free from the Spanish Empire, which was still hanging around from the days of Christopher Columbus. And this was in the 1890s. And so we sent this boat with 250 guys on it to Maine, and we camped it in, we anchored it in Havana Harbor. And we were there for just to kind of lend support to the Cuban rebels. And then all of a sudden it blew up, and all the 250 guys on the boat were killed. And of course the Hearst press went completely nuts and started screaming and yelling that the Spaniards were barbarians, and that they that we needed to go to war against Spain for killing our guys. And Theodore Roosevelt got it together with a whole bunch of these armed thugs, essentially, adventurers and whoever, and put together a group called the Rough Riders. And the Rough Riders came down to Cuba in 1898, and Teddy Roosevelt was their leader. He was at the time, I think, mayor of New York, or maybe governor of New York. And he led them on these charges and killed lots of Spaniards. He actually bragged about killing a Spaniard with his bare hands, always reassuring that you got a guy in the White House who's going to kill somebody with his bare hands. And they took Cuba and took the Philippines, Puerto Rico, and Guam. And this was a major step by the United States into the world of conquering empire. And, you know, all the history books talk about the great victories of the Spanish-American War, how Teddy Roosevelt established himself as a national hero, and the Rough Riders were legendary American fighters. And then in the 1980s, they found the Maine. It wasn't hard to do. It was right in the middle of Havana Harbor, which isn't actually that deep. But this is, you know, with new scuba equipment and all that stuff, they went down to the main and they inspected the ship, and they found very clearly that the Spaniards had not blown up the main. And that, in fact, Teddy Roosevelt had gone down there on a fool's errand. The whole thing, the boat had blown up from the inside. Apparently, there was an explosion at the coal burner inside the battleship Maine. And so the whole adventure, the whole Spanish-American War was built on a lie. And that's relevant today because we're looking at still more prospects for war. This, the Republicans and some of the Democrats are now yelling and screaming that we shouldn't sign the sanctions deal, lifting the sanctions on Iran. It's ridiculous. There are people in this country who are always willing to go to war, and that's why I'm glad to have read just within the last day that it appears that there are enough senators in the U.S. Senate, 34 minimum, to uphold, sustain a veto if the president has to veto a law passed, a bill passed by the House and Senate, stopping him from lifting the sanctions. So hopefully we'll avoid another foolish and worthless war like the Spanish-American, and hopefully, God forbid, John Kasich will not get elected president, and Mount Denali will stay Mount Denali as it was, and we don't revert back to naming it after a guy who put us into a war, the Spanish-American War, based on a total lie. Well, there you go. There's an introduction to Peter Matthews. Peter, are you with us?
Yes, I am. Good to hear from you, Harvey. Good to be here.
I can hear you, too. I'm on Skype now without a microphone, but I assume I can be heard very reasonably well?
Yes, I can hear you very well.
Well, thank you, crew in New York. Never a dull moment with the technical difficulties here. I've not yet seen the new studios. I hope they're great. And I'm really glad. Thank you, guys, for getting this show to go up despite all odds. So, Peter, I am honored to have you on. You are a great, great writer, a great, great activist. Tell us a bit about yourself. We know each other, and I don't paraphrase my guest's bio. So tell us what we need to know about you, and then we're going to launch in to the very substantial content that you bring to the show.
Excellent, Harvey. It's really great to be with you. And, we go back a while, and we work together on a lot of causes. And I got started as an activist when I was in college, in university, when George McGovern was running for president on the anti-war social justice ticket. And my roommates were delegates, state delegates to the convention, and I was joining them and helping campaign for him. And the war, the Vietnam War, was raging when I was in high school and then in college. And we really got involved at the University of North Texas in protesting at People's Park and taking over some times an administration building or two about what we should to make the point that we need to have civil disobedience and peaceful protest that would let the powers that be know we were serious about ending an unjust war. So that got me started there. But also,
wait.
Yeah.
You said something in passing that I can't let go by.
You
at the University of North Texas?
I did, in Denton, for my bachelor's degrees and my master's degrees.
So I actually spoke in Denton at a college, at the Texas Women's College. Is that possible?
Texas Women's University. I lived about half a mile from there. Harvey, I used to jog right by there. My sisters attended there, TWU. Well,
really?
Isn't that amazing? Yes. What year was that, by the way?
1985.
Okay. No, I had moved to California by then, but I was in school in Texas in the university from 1969 to 73 for my bachelor's degrees, and then to 75 for my master's.
So you actually went out at the University of North Texas and demonstrated? I mean, that's...
Absolutely. And the name of the park was People's Park. And we were massive rallies against the war and for civil rights. So, and you, by the way, you were a seminal influence as well because we knew about the No Nukes movement. We were part of that as well. And we knew all about what you were doing nationwide. And we were inspired by what your work was to bring sustainable development and real alternative energy and shut down these nuclear monsters, even back then, and also the weapons, disarm the nuclear weapons, because that's got to go, even today.
Well, I have to say, you know, I went to places, I demonstrated, but I was at places like the University of Michigan in Ann Arbor, at the University of Chicago and New York University. I have to express great admiration for someone who went out and demonstrated at the University of North Texas. I mean, weren't you afraid of being shot?
No, because there actually it was a fairly progressive city because there were two universities there. The faculty were amazing. I had a professor named Dr. Robert Dale Judy, who was a UC Berkeley PhD, and he got me involved with the study about economic and political development in global South countries, the Third World and neo-imperialism. We got into that way back then, class analysis with Dr. Judy, and that really had an impact on me. I was able to see how people are exploited throughout the world in our own country as well.
Well, did you grow up in Texas? Is that why you went to school there?
I know. Actually, I was actually born in India, and I was 10 years old when my dad came and mom came to do their graduate work here. Dad was doing his doctoral work in psychology at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, and we came to visit him a year later in 1962. Ended up staying on. I was in sixth grade in Maryland, so I lived in Maryland, New York, upstate New York, in the Catskills. I went to school in Fallsburg Junior High School and High School. So in New York, upstate, and then Michigan, then New Jersey, and then Texas for the last 2 years of high school and college. And then when I graduated, I went on to California, to Northern California, to teach part-time. I couldn't.
So you did 4 years of college at the University of North Texas in Denton.
I did 4 years of undergrad, two bachelor's degrees in psychology and political science, and then a master's degree in poli-sci with a graduate teaching assistantship for 2 years, till 75. 1975, I finished my master's.
And where did you do that?
At University of North Texas as well.
You did?
And then I came to California in 1976 in the summer and started teaching part-time in Northern California at City College of San Francisco and then Foothill College. And couldn't find full-time work there because Prop 13 had knocked out the funding. So I moved down to Southern California and was able to get work in the 80s, a full-time job at Cypress.
And you've been teaching at Cypress College since the 80s?
Since 1986, actually. And also before that, for 10 years part-time around the Northern and Southern California area. So in L.A. since 1979, I've been in Los Angeles, teaching in L.A. City College, Santa Monica College part-time, and finally got the full-time job at Cypress, which I'm very thankful for.
Wow. Now, I recently visited Cypress College. It's a lovely campus. How many students at Cypress College?
There are about under 20,000, probably more like 18,000 or so, and so many of them are part-time. So, but between 15,000 and 18,000 students.
And it's a two-year community college.
It's a two-year community college, one of the best in the area. We have students coming in from Compton and Watts and Santa Ana and all the surrounding areas, including the beach areas, Huntington Beach. They come to Cypress even though they can go to other colleges in the area because we have a very progressive faculty and people that spend a lot of time with students and care about them a lot on a personal basis. I love it there.
Well, good for you. It's a lovely
place. And love to have you there, Harvey. If we can get you a teacher over there, that'd be great.
Well, from your mouth to God's ears, as my mother used to say. So we will see. We'll see about that. And it's a very new, very shiny campus. Was it like that in the 80s? It was built when?
They keep it up really well, but it was built in the 60s, about 1965, I think was when it was built. So it's got that more neo-modern architecture, but lots of greenery, and they keep things up. They've actually restored some of the buildings, the older buildings, and remodeled them. It's quite nice.
And soon, hopefully, they'll be putting solar panels on all the buildings.
That's what we're looking for, Harvey. I was just talking to a friend of mine who's promoting 100 solar panels per house, rooftop solar panels, which would be decentralized power for American people and would be more efficient as well. So if we can get those panels onto colleges and schools as well, it'll be really fantastic. I'm going to start talking to student trustee about that, actually.
That would be my colleague, Paul Kangas. So I will work with you on that when I come out there. So, Peter,
Paul, that's right.
I have you on the show because you've written a number of books and you're commenting very strongly on the campaign and the influence of money on our politics in particular. I just read a very interesting column by Kareem Abdul-Jabbar. Mm-hmm. You are shorter than he is, but I'm sure you're capable of commenting. He is comparing Donald Trump with Bernie Sanders. And I think you could you might be able to compare Donald Trump with Colonel Sanders, but I don't know about Bernie Sanders.
Right. So what did he say?
He said basically that Bernie is a gentleman, that he handles women very well, that he's he's got a credible campaign going, whereas Donald Trump is just a demagogue and playing up the race card and all that stuff.
Well, I couldn't have said it any better because I even got to meet, what he said is true, and I got to meet Bernie also about 4 months ago before he declared his presidency, at a union hall in L.A., Harvey, and there were only like 500 people there, so I got to actually go up and meet him personally, shake his hand, and gave him a copy of my book, which I signed for him. And I've been commenting a lot about his campaign. We're all quite inspired by it.
Well, let's talk about that. I have to tell you, I live in a suburb of Columbus, Ohio, and the very first yard sign for the 2016 campaign that I have seen in my neighborhood is for Bernie. And it just says Bernie on it. And it's actually one of my colleagues at Capital University. So tell us what you think of Bernie Sanders in the context of money in politics today. First give us the titles of your book so people will know why I've got you on.
Yes, I've got the second edition out right now. It's the same title, but it's got a lot more material in it, more updated data on money and politics, as well as a new chapter, Harvey, on the military-industrial complex, the waste, fraud, and abuse in the Pentagon. And that book is called Dollar Democracy, With Liberty and Justice for Some, How to Reclaim the American Dream for All. So it's an optimistic book after looking at the pessimistic situation that we're in. You know, the book is really geared toward money and politics and how it's affected our lives and healthcare and jobs, outsourcing of jobs, and in GMOs and our food supply and chemicals and Monsanto and our environment, Harvey. There's a whole chapter on the environment and education as well. But the environment chapter goes into air, water, and soil pollution as well as global warming and looks at all the money that's chased these oil companies have put in and Halliburton has put into the campaigns that have given them things like the Halliburton loophole, which exempts any oil fossil fuel industry, oil, coal, and natural gas, they're the only industry exempted from the strictures of the Safe Water Drinking Water Act and the Clean Water Act. So they can get away with murder. They can literally put stuff in and pollute the water and get away with it and be exempt from any prosecution on that because they got the Halliburton loophole. So that's in the book. But the book is basically geared towards saying how we can fix this, how we can take money out of politics through clean money elections, through the Pulse, Wellstone, and Bernie Sanders models. I have Bernie in there, but I got a detailed, extensive expose on Paul Wellstone, who ran a Senate campaign the way Bernie's running his presidential campaign. No corporate money, lots of volunteers, small donors. And then the third way would be to have a 28th Amendment of the Constitution, We the People Amendment, that would take out corporate personhood and remove money and say money is not speech. Those three solutions for this dollar democracy. Anyway, I even have a page at the end with a demand platform, an action plan of 13 demands that I say to people, please contact your member of Congress. Here's their phone number. I gave every single member of Congress's phone number in my book in about 20 pages, their names and numbers, the party affiliation, et cetera, where they're from, and people can call them directly in Washington and tell their assistant, we need to talk to this guy, and we need to tell your man, give up the corporate money, close the loopholes, clean up the environment. So there's a 13-point platform there, which are the solutions to this crisis that we have.
I want to go through that with you, but first let's talk about Bernie Sanders.
Wait, let's talk about Bernie real quick. I want to talk about Bernie. I want to say that Bernie is a living example of what I've been talking about in that book, that we need politicians who will run without corporate money, politicians who have served and paid their dues on the grassroots level as he has as in Burlington, Vermont, as mayor. He ran several times and lost because he refused money from developers and corporations. Then he wins with just 10 votes finally as Burlington mayor on a tremendous platform that was sustainable. It has to do with reducing utility costs and taking the government money and buying the private utility out and knocking out the corporate profits and the utilities and lowering people's costs. And also, he ran on environmental issues in Burlington. And once he did that for the people, they elected him to Congress. And he's never accepted money from corporate lobbyists and PACs, but instead has accepted only individual contributions and volunteers. So my book, he's a living example of what my book says all the people running for office should be like. And we're very inspired by him. I've come out and spoke about him on KPFA and KPFK and WBAI and other radio stations saying that this is the way all politicians should go, and American people have to demand that. So it's very exciting to be part of that. My Facebook page is just lit up all the time. I mean, I had 1,100 friends before I started working to promote Bernie's ideas, and now I've got 2,600 friends in 2 weeks, Harvey. It's amazing.
Well, when you figure out how to operate Facebook, let me know. I'd appreciate it. We'll talk with Peter Matthews, author of Dollar Democracy, a great advocate of getting money out of politics, and professor at Cypress College in Southern California. Peter, I actually knew Paul Wellstone. We spoke together at Kent State University once, and we then took a walk at a conference there, and then he's such a great speaker. And then we took a walk together and we went to the Kent State Memorial. It was interesting, I recall, because we were both in our middle ages at that point. And instead of wondering what it would have been like to have been a student there, we wondered what it would have been like to be a parent whose student was killed there, whose child was killed there. But Paul was a great guy, and I hope to God that what was done, you know, I still am of the opinion that he was very likely murdered. He went down in a private plane. And I just hope the same doesn't happen to Bernie Sanders. You know, the Las Vegas.
I certainly hope not. And let me tell you, Paul Wellstone's death could have been. I think there's a good amount of evidence that there was some foul play, because when he, not only the evidence for how the plane was pointed and the weather was good when they landed, but they still crashed. But other than that, the fact that the Senate turned over to Republican hands by one vote when Wellstone's seat was lost to Norm Coleman. And Mondale couldn't hold on to it. So this is amazing stuff. And Wellstone voted against the war, against funding the war in Iraq and approving of it for Bush a few days before that happened to him. And I did get to meet Paul, by the way, Harvey. Paul campaigned for me when I ran for Congress in 1998 from Long Beach. I was able to get him to speak up in a Beverly Hills event for me and say that Peter's a progressive like I am and he doesn't take corporate money. And we got lots of support from that. I got 45% of the vote in the general election against a so-called moderate Republican who was pro-choice, who was tough to beat. He had five times the money I did, Steve Horn. He got 52%, 45 to 52, and Paul's support was a big part of that. I got to meet Paul 2 years later when I was supporting him for his exploratory campaign for president, which I donated to him a little bit. So now we have Bernie, who is, in a sense, in the same spirit of Paul, and it's just wonderful.
Well, I hope Bernie doesn't ride on too many private planes.
No.
I mean, this is a serious issue. I don't think the corporations would let Bernie Sanders become president, frankly. And it's something we really need to look at.
We need to look at it very carefully and then take precautions to get him the kind of protection he needs right now. The people are starting to demand that he get Secret Service protection right now. I think he should. That should be made a major and protection from our own, from his own friends who have ability to protect him physically. That has to be there, because you're right. You know what, Harvey? If he gets elected, is he able to get people on his coattails to be progressive like him and maybe get some progressives in there like him, and Congress turns around supporting his platform, it's going to be a shift of hundreds of billions of dollars from the corporate elite, the top 1/10 of 1% to the 99.9%. In so many ways, the economic rewards of hard work will go to the 99.9% people, which is us. And that's what they fear, all the trillions of dollars that will shift hands.
Right, and of course, you know, he's the only candidate talking about that.
In
Iowa, I think he's around 40%, and Hillary's around 47%, something like that. So he's showing very substantial numbers.
And, very substantial. He's also ahead of Hillary in New Hampshire, as you know, by 7%.
Yeah, well, that would stand to reason. I think he would carry all of New England, frankly. And New Hampshire is actually the most conservative state in New England. So we'll certainly do well in Maine and Connecticut and Rhode Island and Massachusetts. So,
And he's done work in South Carolina. South Carolina comes along the line. There's Nevada and South Carolina, early states as well. He could. We need some work there.
He won't do so well in South Carolina. I think he'll do fine in Nevada. The Democrats, it's a very heavily unionized state.
Right, that's true.
But, and he'll do fine in California. He'll do well in the Northeast and well on the West Coast. It's in the middle he won't do so well. But,
one more thing, Harvey, you don't mind. He has been, you know, at the beginning attacked for not being sensitive to the African-American community. But believe me, Bernie was a civil rights frontline organizer, and he's got such a record of being pro-civil rights. I spoke out about that on KPFA and told him to set the record straight. And furthermore, he's done a lot since that little flare-up with Black Lives Matter. He's actually put a lot of the folks from that community involved in his campaign. He's addressed there. He's got a great platform on race and class. Have you seen his platform, his written platform?
No, but I'll take a look at it. I mean, I would imagine it's terrific. And I think I would recommend to you the column by Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, who's quite brilliant, actually, talking about and also – Kareem dealt with the Black Lives Matter issue and basically said that Bernie handled it pretty well, which I'm sure he did. And it's interesting. I hadn't thought about Paul Wellstone for a long time. He was a wonderful guy. I'm a little biased. I met him. He was already in the Senate when I met him, And I introduced myself, and he had actually read my history of the United States. I was so, you know, it really made me glow, and he was very complimentary, and we became friends after that.
And I met Sheila, his wife Sheila, too. My wife and I met Paul and Sheila in the Beverly Hills event, and she's a remarkable woman. You know, she was a remarkable woman because she perished with him as well. You know, she fought against the battering of women and for the liberating and helping to protect and redress the battering of women. And this legislation was passed after he passed away, the legislation that she was pushing through him.
Right. So we need to be conscious of this, actually, when Bernie is doing this. I mean, this is a very big deal. You know, he clearly, in a head-to-head, I think, if there was an action, well, we have to deal with the electronic voting issue, which I'll talk about in a minute.
Yeah,
in an actual vote count, mm-hmm. if Bernie Sanders ran today against Donald Trump or any one of these other Republican clowns,
so he'd wipe them out.
Yeah, he'd win. I think he'd win.
The polls are showing that. Yeah.
And Trump would never be, you know, there's a lot of rednecks. I mean, there's a lot of people in this country who agree with what Trump is saying. I don't think Trump agrees with a lot of things he's saying, frankly. I think Trump is basically a performance artist.
To get support.
He's out there having
a
good time, you know. He's got nothing to lose. It's a moneymaker for him. And, you know, he doesn't care. What does he care?
But you know what I liked about that first debate, the Republican debate? He came out and said, look, I've bought these people. Even you guys on stage, you politicians, I gave you money, and you did me favors a few months later when I came to you. For the first time on a national stage, you heard that by a person who's speaking out, you know?
Right.
I'm
and
sure
also,
you,
by
I
the way,
agree
the
with
campaign,
most of
I want to mention this. It's very funny. You know that Stephen Colbert is going to go back on nighttime TV there.
He's going
to take over, I guess it's the David Letterman slot. And I don't know why he did it, but on his first show, he has invited George Clooney and Jeb Bush. And so Jeb Bush, you know, do you know about this? Jeb Bush put out a fundraising letter saying, if you join this lottery, if you give me $3, you know, obviously expecting tons of people, I'll put your name in a lottery. And if you win the lottery, you get a VIP seat at my appearance at the Stephen Colbert Show.
Oh, my God. Raising money that way?
Well, wait, but dig this. He never asked Colbert. So Colbert, I just watched this a few minutes ago. Colbert put out a video. He's sitting, only Colbert could pull this off. He's sitting in the studio, and the studio is empty, and he's just totally ripping Jeb Bush. And then he says, you know, it's really wonderful that Jeb did this, but he never asked me. And you know, and so he, I forget, Colbert offered to do something, sell a duck ticket to donate to some charity based on what you win with Jeb Bush, you get the seat, which I guess, you know, when you're a guest on the Tonight Show or whatever it is, you probably get a free seat. And so, you know, in the audience. And so, obviously, Jeb Bush is raffling off his free seat.
He's
offering a free dinner with some guy named Woody Johnson, who owns the New York Jets. And so Colbert is offering the same deal if you donate to him, but you get to go to dinner with his accountant.
That's hilarious.
I mean, who wants
only
to
only Colbert could pull that off. Yeah,
it's the owner of the Jets. Anyway, it's very funny. Anybody listening, I highly recommend listening to that or watching, pulling it up. You know, Google Jeb Bush and Colbert.
Will.
So, you know, I got to say, I'm concerned about Bernie Sanders' health, but there's no doubt. And you know, all the media bloviators who are playing reporting on the campaign are playing it like a horse race, and Bernie Sanders this and Bernie Sanders that. They don't dare talk about, well, they don't talk about him much, frankly, but they also
about his issues, but the issues.
Yeah, they don't dare talk about the issues and the reason why he's drawing these huge crowds. I mean, I don't know if you went, I was in LA a while ago, and I guess a few weeks ago, and he had an event at the LA Forum or one of the basketball arenas, and he drew almost 30,000 people.
Almost 30,000. That's correct.
Way
bigger than Trump ever drew, even in Alabama.
Now you could take all the candidates, every one of them, and have them do all the Republicans plus Hillary, have them each do a separate event, and they wouldn't get together 30,000 candidates.
No, they wouldn't.
This wouldn't happen.
This is a consistent big draw in all these grassroots campaign events that he's doing.
Right.
And it's because of his message. It's because also not more than as much as his message, it's the belief in this man that he's genuine. He's got a record, a track record of 40 years of serving regular folks against the biggest elites. The David versus Goliath. He's the David, my friend. He's the genuine David.
He's everybody's, radical Jewish uncle is what he is.
I love it.
So here,
I
guess he's married. He has kids, I guess. I mean, he's had a
Yes. Kids and grandkids.
Grandkids. So there you go.
Yeah.
He is substantially older than Ronald Reagan was. When Reagan, I think he's what, 73?
He's 73, and Reagan was 69, I believe, when he was elected.
Yes, and now Bernie is 73. So this is old. He would be by far the oldest guy elected president. But
But he's got such energy, Harvey. I met him, like I said, in person. I heard him speak, and this guy's got energy that the youngest people love and are motivated by him.
Right. All right, so let's talk about the issues now. You have Peter Matthews, author of Dollar Democracy. You have a 13-point platform for reforming our American system. Now, you go around speaking regularly. You're a professor at Cypress College, and you have a lot to say on the politics of the United States. Unfortunately, you can't run for president because you were born in India. If you altered your birth certificate and said Indiana, you might get away with it. You could slip in an eye there, but we won't count on that. So tell us, what is your platform? What is the essence of your campaigning and your book for reforming the American political system?
Let me just go over the 13 points. It'll only take about 3 minutes right here, word for word, in the back on page 285.
Well, do the first one and let's talk about it.
What's that?
What's your first point?
Oh, my first point is give up campaign money from corporate lobbyists and win without it, as Professor Paul Wellstone did in his grassroots campaign and became the U.S. Senator from Minnesota. So I'm asking people to call their member of Congress on these and demand these 13 points be implemented by them, or they're going to get thrown out of the office by voters. The second one is run as clean money candidates.
Well, here, wait. Let's stop with that.
Yeah.
Peter, let's stop.
Sure.
I want you to take some time when you're going through this. So the first point is no more corporate money.
That's right.
And I assume you are, of course, supporting the Constitution Amendment that would strip corporations of the so-called their personhood.
Absolutely. In fact, I've taken a lead on that. I'm one of the activist speakers for it. It's called the 28th We the People Amendment. It's from the Move to Amend People. It would completely take out corporate personhood and say corporations are not natural persons with natural rights protected by the 10 Amendments, the first 10 Amendments and the 14th Amendment. And the second thing is that money is not speech. So I'm pushing that one, yes. And I'm asking people to give the candidates to people to tell their candidates for office, and the incumbent candidates especially, give up your corporate money, win without it, as Professor Wellstone did in his grassroots campaign. Secondly, run as clean money candidates like they do in Maine and Arizona, other states that have clean money elections. Third, rely on volunteers.
Stop there.
Yeah.
What is a clean money election?
What are the
details of a clean money election?
Yes, it's pioneered in the state of Maine, was the first one to implement it back in 1998. They passed it. And they ran their whole election system in 2000 on clean money and on until today. And the way it works is it's voluntary public financing of campaigns. So the state of Maine, if you're running for state office, such as state legislator, state assembly, you can become a clean money candidate by pledging to not accept or spend any private money, even your own. And you have to just only get $5 contributions as a nominating fee from 65 voters in your district. Once you turn that money over, the $300 or so, over to the Election Commission of Maine, they put you on the ballot automatically when you sign the pledge that you will receive no private money and raise it or spend it. And then the government of Maine, the Election Commission, sends you a check for several thousand dollars to reach the several thousand voters in your district. And you can use that money in any way you want. You could buy a TV commercial, make flyers, have pizza parties, and you don't have to stay on the phone begging for money from rich and corporate people. So then you're free. The state of Maine had 80% of its legislature immediately elected Clean Money Way, and they brought in a comprehensive health care system. They were the first state to do it with 93% coverage, which was remarkable back in 1998. So Maine.
How did they wind up with such an idiot governor? The governor of Maine is a complete lunatic.
At that time, they passed it anyway, and this time you got the new governor who's totally idiotic in so many ways. But what happened is there's a whole 70% of the Maine legislature, the state Senate and the state House of Representatives, 70% today our clean money candidates. So they can override the governor. They can override a veto with that kind of number, see, the clean money people. And I've got my friend Thomas Longstaff. I interviewed him for my book. He's a state representative from Maine, a clean money representative, and he's got remarkable inside information on how to do this. It works very well in Maine. It works in Arizona as well, but not as many progressives were elected. There were some non-corporate candidates, even on the right wing, that got elected, the far right, but there were also progressives got elected in Arizona, and other states are using parts of it. But that's clean money elections that is not in the, implemented in the federal level yet. We have to get, there's a legislative act, there's a bill that's being proposed in Congress, that's a clean money bill that's being bottled up by the Candace Miller, the congresswoman in charge of the Government Operations Committee. She's bottled up for a couple of years. She won't let it out of the committee to be able to be voted upon. But I'm pushing that clean money bill in the federal government as well, to the federal Congress.
All right.
Those are the two things. Yeah.
Very good. So let's move ahead now. Yeah. What's your next point?
Yeah, let's move ahead. The next, of course, is rely on volunteers and small donations from individuals in your campaign. Now, here's the kicker. Here's the economic side. Close unnecessary corporate tax loopholes to bring in money to invest in America and pay down the national debt. Next one, create high-paying jobs.
You're jumping through. Yeah. These are enormous things.
Okay, let's go over these. Let's go ahead. Yeah.
Expand on this one. What are we talking about here?
I'm talking about these corporate tax loopholes, of which I have a whole list of 40 corporations. There are hundreds of them, but I only got the top 40 by the Citizens for Tax Justice. They listed companies like Murphy Oil, Fluor Corporation, Facebook, Texas Instruments, Sempra Energy. These corporations have paid no taxes in the year 2012, for example, when they were making hundreds of millions in profit. And in the case of Facebook, they made $1.062 billion in profit that year, paid zero income tax because of the so-called stock option loophole passed by Congress. These are loopholes that allow companies to get away with paying no taxes. And then Facebook received $429 million in a corporate welfare, meaning the government wrote them a check for $429 million. So they had a negative tax burden of 40.4%. Instead of paying taxes, these companies have gotten paid by the government to promote their products around the world through taxpayer money. So I'm saying close these loopholes, bring in almost $500 billion, about $500 billion a year you could bring in, and then you could start paying for free college-free tuition for all our students across the United States, tuition-free college. You could support more funding for the low-income K-12 districts to do all kinds of things that we need. So that money, that's the whole idea about closing corporate loopholes and investing in America. And you can even use part of that money to pay down the national debt so we're not paying off the interest to rich people and losing investments every year in our budget. That's what I meant by that particular point. The next one is create high – yeah, go ahead. You want me to go forward? You want something?
Yeah,
you got
go
a question
ahead.
On that.
Go ahead.
Yeah. Create high-paying jobs and stop outsourcing them. This has to do with free trade versus fair trade. And the lack of public investment in research and development technology. In our government, instead of having a government agency that could actually have public hired scientists and cutting-edge researchers out of colleges, put them to work coming up with the best technology for solar, for electric cars, electric trains, high-speed rail. And let's make these products and export them around the world to create jobs here. And we're not doing that. Instead, our government gives tax breaks to corporations to come up with new products, and they don't do it. They basically take the money and they run. They take their businesses and set them up overseas. And the government actually subsidizes the moving of corporate factories from here to Indonesia and other countries. The government pays their moving expenses, Harvey. That's another corporate welfare. So I'm saying this has got to be stopped. I'm telling the voters, they should tell the members of Congress to do this. Do it or get out. We're going to vote you out. We're going to create voting blocks in your district. District by district, nationwide, created voting blocks of several thousand voters who will throw out the corporate representatives of both parties. Okay, the next one is bring back quality tuition-free education as in all other advanced countries and as in California from 1960 to 1980. For 20 years, we had tuition-free education here all the way through UC Berkeley Law School and Medical School at UCLA. Tuition-free, and so many of my friends are in their 60s now, were able to live the American dream because of that. And yet today, our students have $30,000 in debt each. Each student with a bachelor's degree graduating has a $30,000 debt on the average for a total of $1.3 trillion student debt nationwide, Harvey, and it's the only debt that cannot be written off in bankruptcy. That was
passed by Congress. Yeah, that's insane. And not only that, the interest rate on student loans is double the home mortgage rate.
That's right. And much of those loans are to private banks, aren't they?
Well, they were sold out. They sold turned over by the government to private banks.
Yeah,
it's sickening.
That's a crime. So here's the other one:
And then, and as you say, every country in Europe has free college education. You have to graduate
Germany,
high school, and you have to
pass certain
tests.
Like all the other countries in Europe that have free tuition, college tuition, Germany has it as well, and now they have a program that about 90 bachelor's degree programs that anyone who speaks English in the world, a foreign student, can come to Germany and apply for the program, and if they get accepted, which means basically meeting some certain academic requirements, the English-speaking foreign student in Germany gets tuition-free education for a bachelor's degree or even for master's degrees. They have that program now where the German government pays for foreign students to get a college education tuition-free.
That's amazing.
Now,
we have to remember, I taught this today in my classes. The United States, Franklin Roosevelt, had the great vision during World War II to do the GI Bill. The GI Bill is probably the most successful piece of social legislation ever done in any country. And what he did was he told all the 15 million guys that were in the military, and they were almost all guys, that when you're done with military service and when we've defeated Hitler, you'll come back and you'll have a free college education. Now, of course, the one thing they didn't think about was we didn't have enough colleges to accommodate all these people. And so, right after World War II, we had the biggest expansion of colleges in the history of the world. And
look what it did to our economy. It was the humane thing to do, and the economy boomed, didn't it, post-World War
II? It
did. And homeownership went up. The GIs were able to buy their homes.
Ohio State, Michigan State, all these other places, these were ag schools. And suddenly New York University and the University of California system, they had to muscle up, and we built the greatest university system in the history of the world. And we had the best educated workforce in the history of the world. People came to the United States from all over the world to study here. And they brought their tuition money, and they also learned English and loved the United States. You always love where you went to college. And then they went back and did business with us.
They did business, and then if they became political leaders, they were much more friendly and amenable to the United States. They had been touched by us. We call that soft power too. Joseph Nye talks about it, a Harvard professor. Soft power is non-military weapon power, the power of our example, of our philosophy and ideas, the power of our foreign policy when it's based on morality. This is the kind of soft power that the United States needs to employ more of and stop using so much money on these horrible weapons, many of whom that don't work. I got that document in my book, by the way. The defense contractors have been just gouging us for the F-35 airplane, which they promised to us. Lockheed Martin promised this plane back in 20 years ago for $69 million apiece. That's a lot of money. But in the end, this plane can't even perform, according to the Rand Corporation. It doesn't perform well. It caught fire several times. It's been grounded. And it's costing the federal government now, the Defense Department, $367 million apiece for the Navy version. It's just outrageous. And the budget was passed last year to buy two or three of those planes for $1 billion. Complete waste.
Right. And then we're also putting $10 billion into more nuclear submarines, perfectly designed to fight ISIS, of course, and all the other real
things. They're out there on the ocean, aren't they?
I mean, these people are just so corrupt. It's really
And my book exposes why they're doing it, because of the dollar democracy, because of the money and lobbyists chasing the politicians from these defense contractors. They don't care about defending America. They care about making more profits, basically.
Right. I mean, if you really want to defend America, let's have health care. If you want to talk about national security, let's beef up Social Security, give everybody health care, give the Medicaid program to everybody in the country, fix the environment, and then you'll have national security.
That will make our country strong. Yes, and check this out, Harvey. We got 1,000 military bases around the world, 1,000 in 150 countries out of 195 countries. There's no other country in the world or in the history of mankind or humankind that has ever had that kind of military extension around the world, which is military offense, not defense.
Right, and are there any countries on this planet that the United States has not invaded?
That's a good one. I got to look up that list.
I'm surprised to hear there are 40 countries in the world where we don't have bases.
That's true. There are 40 said, no, we don't want American bases. We're not going to get them. But 150 have them. And China and Russia, the next largest powers that seek to influence the world, they may have one or two, if anything, military bases in any other country. They don't even have more than that if they have even that. So, it's just unbelievable, the difference. And by the way, those 1,000 bases cost us $250 billion a year. In taxpayer money to maintain them, just to maintain them. Right,
that's not even the other stuff. So
that's right. Not even the other. Wait a minute.
Okay,
let me, can
very
I finish
good.
Up
okay,
my
Peter,
list here?
What's your next point?
Yeah, my next point is, here we go. Stop big corporations from destroying our air, water, and soil, and switch from fossil fuels to renewable energy immediately. The next one, and that can be
done. Peter, you're running over these giant things, and and they're huge. So tell us about
this.
What's your program agenda here for converting the federal government to renewable energy?
Yes, my program agenda is take the subsidies that they are giving to the oil companies. It's huge, in hundreds of billions a year, and put that money to subsidizing producers of renewable energy in the form of even subsidies for those who could purchase it or set up those rooftop solar panels. The government could help Americans buy those solar panels and also update the electric grid. But if you have decentralized solar, it even helps with that. And I think the government should put in money into research and development to hire college students coming out with the cutting-edge technology to make these systems even better. For example, China now is the cutting edge of solar. They've got those thin film solar, which we don't have yet to the extent that China does, and the Chinese are coming out with the first solar-powered car within a year. So we could do all that if we just put the money, stop the subsidies, close the loopholes for the oil companies and coal companies, and put the money into the renewable people, which includes
private
and public
enterprise. You're saying that China is going to have a solar-powered car, I mean, with panels on the car?
That's right, which will charge in 4 hours and run 50-mile range, which will be a great car just for commuting to work. And you can just let the car sit outside in the parking lot. When you're at work, it'll be recharged again. You know, it's just remarkable.
And they're coming out next year with it?
I think in about a year and a half. It's not quite ready. They were planning on a year, but they're being delayed a little bit. But they're going to come out with it. And they've got this thin film solar panels, which are more efficient. They capture more energy, store more energy, and they're flexible. So that's what I'm saying about getting these big fossil fuel dinosaur corporations out of the industry, or get them to transition to the renewable energy industry. They don't, get them out of business. Get the government involved and support the entrepreneurs who are doing this already. The government should support them with tax subsidies, with tax support, and that'll get it going, the new energy. That's what we want, renewable energy.
And, of course, the government buildings themselves, including the military bases. Well, we need to get rid of the military bases. But the ones that we keep, maybe one or two, they should be totally on the new
solar, rooftop solar, absolutely. Just like the colleges and universities, which are public. That should be all the government buildings should have solar immediately. So that's what I would push for this point. And the next one, this is an important one too, Harvey.
Okay.
Stop big corporations from endangering our lives with harmful chemicals, pesticides, and genetically modified foods, GMOs, and then require labeling of GMOs. These members of Congress are running for office and want our vote. They have to do this right away. This is ridiculous how much cancer rates have gone up, how the pesticides, glyphosate, for example, in Roundup, which Monsanto produces, is horribly poisonous. And, you know, my neighbor is spraying glyphosate. He's spraying that Roundup for his weeds, and my little daughter is right there in the driveway. That's ridiculous. It's happening all over America, and that's
not the top. Yeah, that stuff needs to be totally banned. And, of course, they also use 2,4-D and 2,4-5-T, the basic elements of Agent Orange, using that to spread in neighborhoods as well. I mean, it's really sickening, and it's a good point is well taken that these corporations have got to be stopped from even producing.
And don't forget the GMO foods, Harvey. Those are just horrible. We know the Institute for Responsible Technology in Iowa, IRT, headed by Dr. Jeffrey Smith, who wrote the book Seeds of Deception. They've got some great independent research not funded by corporations that show that GMO foods are horrendous for our digestive tracts. They create lesions in the stomachs of rats, all kinds of things that are really bad.
Yeah, and the whole purpose of GMO foods, of GMO crops, is to facilitate the use of glyphosate.
It truly works hand in hand.
The whole deal is that Monsanto wants to gear our entire food supply to use Roundup.
That's it.
And it's absolutely insane in terms of the survival of the human race. You know, sometimes I think these corporations were put on this planet by some hostile alien extraterrestrial
force.
Want us to commit suicide. I mean,
Frankenstein monster. In my book, I refer to the corporation as the Frankenstein monster, which Dr. Frankenstein lost control of, even though he created it.
This is where
we got to bring them under control again.
Well, that's the basic nature of a corporation. Corporations were set in place, and there's this one mechanism that
makes a corporation, which is that the owners and operators are not liable for the damage done by the corporations.
And that's totally irresponsible.
Mm-hmm. Right. And secondly, they have one legal mandate and only one, and that is to make money. So
and to maximize profits. Yeah.
So the basic nature of the corporation has changed. Talking with Peter Matthews here. Peter, we're actually out of time. I'm going to have you back next week if you can do it. And we want to continue to go through your work. You and I have spoken together, and you have actually graciously brought me down to Cypress College. And but you've got a ton more to say, and we have 3 minutes to do it. So tell us how to get a hold of you and your books, please.
Sure, sure. Yes, my website is epetermatthews.com. Matthews is one T, M-A-T-H-E-W-S. The letter E, then petermatthews.com. And you can always find the book on amazon.com, at Barnes & Noble's. You can find it at neighborhood independent bookstores, which I favor. Any bookstore is able to order my book and get it to you within a couple of days.
Have you published it yourself? Do you own this book?
It was published by, actually, Ingram Sparks, which is the Barnes & Noble subsidiary. But I'm the one who's in charge of it, yes, basically.
All right, so very good. Dollar Democracy.
Yeah, Dollar Democracy with Liberty and Justice for Some.
All right, Peter Matthews, professor of political science at Cypress College. And what is your email? Your website again?
It's epetermatthews, MATHEWS.com. And my email is Matthews, MATHEWS, at MSN.com.
MSN.
Matthews@MSN.com.
Okay. And hopefully you'll be on MSNBC one of these days, but apparently you're going in the other direction.
I'm ready to go. Very good.
All right. Now, I want to thank the crew in New York for getting us through another technical miasma. We got a good show going here. We'll do it again next week. Peter, if you'll gear up to do it, we'll start with Skype, and we'll see how it goes. So this has been the Soul-Topia Green Power and Wellness Show. Harvey Wasserman. Thank the crew in New York, and we'll be back with Peter Matthews next week on the Soul-Topia Green Power and Wellness Show.
Either way, we got what we needed when the sun shone down on the Garden of Eden.
Don't you know we're gonna have a Soul-Topia, Soul-Topia, Soul-Topia.